This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Good evening. This is Rock Cash, your host this week on A People Speak. The People Speak invites audience participation. You can listen by phone calling 716-748-0144. Or if you have a computer or a smartphone, go to bbsradio.com and navigate to station 2. Click on the listen icon. You can also participate during the show with calling questions for our guests toll-free USA and Canada, 888-429-5471. Joining me tonight, I'm very proud to have this couple that has sacrificed so much. Craig and Cindy Corey, parents of peace activist Rachel Corey. For those of you who might not or might remember Rachel Corey, she was killed by an Israeli bulldozer as she tried to stand in the way of it when the Israelis were trying to demolish a Palestinian home, a Zionist ritual that has been going on for a long time. Corey stood tall as she fought against the injustice being done to the Palestinians. You can find out more about Rachel's fight by going to her foundation website at rachelcoreyfoundation.org. Help support the fight for peace and justice by following in her footsteps. Craig and Cindy, Corey, welcome to The People Speak.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that it was a very, very harsh day for you today listening to Netanyahu speak here in the United States.
You know, we last night had a great opportunity on the other side of our state. We're based in Olympia, Washington, which is just about an hour south of Seattle. And last night in Spokane, Washington, there was a performance of the play, My Name is Rachel Corey, and we traveled to see the play and had a wonderful evening there with a full house. Every seat was taken, and because of that, we were driving today, coming from Spokane, and were engaged the whole time, so we really didn't listen to Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech. We did hear about it. We heard some commentary about it, but we were not able to listen to it.
Lucky you.
Yeah, we joined, I think, 25 to 50 members of Congress. So last night somebody asked us about it, and I said, you know, Rachel had a full house, but Netanyahu is not going to have a full house. So you go, Rachel.
Absolutely. I thought it was absurd that Senator Brennan invited him to speak without informing the president or even getting the permission from the other people in Congress to do so. I believe that it's a treasonous manner to have a treasonous man. First of all, Netanyahu sold out his American identity for Israel. In other words, he left the United States and he went to Israel, the country where he was born. He went to Israel, and he's fighting for a foreign nation. And to me, that is pretty much a treasonous situation. I view the senators that invited him are being treasonous to our own people because their only concern is Israel. And that's not the way it should be. Their only concern should be the American public. What are your thoughts on that, Craig?
Well, treason, of course, is defined pretty specifically in the Constitution, and that's probably a word that goes a little bit farther than I would go. But, you know, I was thinking, we were back in D.C. a couple of years ago, and I found this document. You can find it, too. It's in room 108 of the Best Western that's near the Pentagon, and it starts talking, it's the Declaration of Independence happened to be hanging on the wall there. And I thought about how different it is if you, you know, we know why this country was founded, and it's founded because we believe all people have certain inalienable rights. And that's a very different reason for being than saying you're going to get a Jewish state, which inevitably means some people have more rights than others. And so I think that, you know, while we can recognize some of the suffering of the Jewish people, that's a whole lot different than setting up a government with a military that is trying to expropriate other people's land for them. And, you know, I think that United States foreign policy has to recognize that difference. I think for the sake of certainly my Jewish friends inside and outside of Israel, you want to make that difference. And so I particularly don't think Netanyahu, when he calls us again to war, is doing any service to the United States when he comes here.
Oh, well, all he's calling for is death and destruction as he did prior to the Iraq war. I think the American people have had enough of this, and it's showing as far as a lot of the congressional people that refused to listen to him speak today. And the ones that did were not too pleased with him at all, which is a good thing. Maybe our politicians will start working their way away from the grip that the Israeli cabal has on our politicians, hopefully. Now, my next question to you, Craig and Cindy, is how come you did not sue Israel in the United States instead of suing them in their own country?
There are a lot of limitations on legal actions that can be taken in cases like this, particularly when a U.S. citizen is killed in a different country. So while we looked at the options that we had, and frankly, none of them were too attractive, taking legal action was a last resort for us. And it's been a very long, as people know, pretty exhausting process in a lot of ways. We've had enormous help from certainly from our attorneys and from friends in Israel, Palestinian and Jewish Israeli friends who have supported us through the whole ordeal of carrying on this lawsuit there. But to do it in the United States, we asked for initially, and our congressman, Brian Baird at the time, asked for an American investigation into what happened in Rachel's case. And there was a resolution before the U.S. Congress that our congressman, Rachel's congressman, Brian Baird, submitted in the House of Representatives in 2003, shortly after Rachel was killed. It called simply for condolences to our family, for the U.S. and Israel to work together to make sure nothing like this happened again, and for there to be this U.S. investigation. We got more signatures on that resolution than our congressman ever imagined that we would, because of the fact that it was dealing with an Israeli matter. He expected maybe 30 members of Congress would sign that, but because of really persistent lobbying by people all over the country who, again, helped us tremendously, and by members of our extended family who managed to help us visit every single office in the U.S. Congress at that time, we got 78 members of Congress to sign on to say that that should happen, that there should be a U.S. investigation. And that was pretty amazing to us. But the resolution never came out of committee. It was in a subcommittee that was chaired by Ileana Ross-Lehtinen, who's a congresswoman from Florida who is has extremely strong support of Israel as part of her practice and program in the Congress. And so though it could have come out in a number of ways, it never did. Still, it provided a very good avenue for people to talk about this issue and to talk with their own members of Congress about Rachel's case, but also about the broader issues, the reasons that she went to Palestine and to Israel in the first place. We did, of course, work with the U.S. government to determine whether the investigation, there had been an investigation promised to President Bush by Prime Minister Sharon immediately after Rachel was killed, the day after in a phone conversation. And the U.S. was told that there would be a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation. When we went to the Department of State after that ended and no charges were brought, the Israeli military was found to be completely flawless in what they had done, we went back to the Department of State, and the chief of staff to Colin Powell, Lawrence Wilkerson, wrote to us in a letter that he could say without equivocation that the report that they had seen from the military police investigation did not reflect an investigation that was thorough, credible, and transparent. So at that go ahead.
I'm sorry, but there is nothing that's credible or transparent that comes out of Israel. Nothing whatsoever.
Yeah, but you may be right there, and just it's the long story here, and maybe kind of a quick part of your point, though, is that if you try to sue in the United States, the first hurdle you have to get over is suing a foreign government. And so you may be thinking of people that sued the Palestinian Liberation Organization and won a huge settlement in that case recently. But to sue a government, you probably have to take that to the Supreme Court. That might cost $1 million. And then the other point is that what we wanted was answers and accountability. And the problem with answers is, for a civil lawsuit, how is a U.S. court going to compel the witnesses, the Israeli military, to come to the United States and be questioned by our attorneys and to go through discovery? So if you're looking for answers, it seemed to us that even given the liabilities of working, you know, the home court advantage that their attorneys had, certainly in Israel, it still was where we had to do it, I think, just to get the sort of thing we wanted out of the case.
Right. I know. It's a difficult situation. If I were the Supreme Court and I was looking after American interest in American people, then I would reserve the money that Israel is supposedly getting, or these people are getting, and make sure that Israel pays its debt to the people that it's killed. I mean, there's so much injustice even here with our own court system, and I believe that's because the Zionists have a foothold pretty much in every legislative part and also every Supreme Court ongoings that is going on, because it's evident that we're losing rights left and right, and there's nothing that we can do about it. So a Jewish friend of mine told me tonight, he's like, it seems like everybody in the United States is going to be getting an Israeli passport. And I'm like...
I don't know. Cindy, do you want to reply to that? I think it goes a long ways. And again,
yes, it does.
But yeah, I think there are specific U.S. laws that are being violated here. You know, when we send money abroad, and we spend somewhere between, on an average, of $3 to $4 billion a year to Israel, and that's almost entirely military aid. And that legally has strings attached. So when we find out that the military aid is used for human rights violations, we're supposed to either withhold the aid or make sure that those violations, that somebody does something active to make sure those violations don't happen again. And so in that sense, you're absolutely right. We need to uphold the U.S. laws about all this. That's one of the first things we can do. And I think that all of this erodes our feelings, I mean, our laws. And I also I don't think you go and blame somebody else for that. You know, we have a democracy. We should be standing up for our own rights. We should be sounding off loud and clear. And our legislature and our courts and our executive branch all ought to be standing up for United States citizens and their rights first. That's our obligation as part of a democracy.
Correct. All right, you're listening live to The People Speak. This is your host, Rakesh. Joining me are my guests, Craig and Cindy Corey, parents of Rachel Corey. You can find out more about Rachel Corey by going to rachelcoreyfoundation.org. We're coming out to you live over the BBS radio network. Craig and Cindy, what's next for you guys? Are you guys, we know you're in on the fight, but what's your next step? Do you have a bunch of volunteers that are coming out and taking the footsteps of Corey and going over there and standing up for justice?
Well, you know, throughout this 12 years, we've made many trips to the Middle East, to Gaza 5 times, to the West Bank. We've lost count, and we were in Israel for about 9 months, not consecutively, but we actually lived in Haifa for about 9 months while our case was being argued in the Haifa District Court. And during that time, we've had opportunity in all those places to connect with activists coming from all parts of the world that do go to Palestine to stand in solidarity with Palestinians. And we've become connected to families, Palestinian activists engaged in nonviolent resistance in places like Belain, where it's a small village not too far from Ramallah, where the whole village for years now has been resisting nonviolently to the land, their land being appropriated for settlement development. They made a decision as a village to counter that with nonviolent resistance for the sake of their children. And two members of that community, whose family were quite connected to now, Bassam Abu Rakhma and his sister, both died as a result of, well, Bassam because he was hit with a tear gas canister during a demonstration that killed him, and the sister because of tear gas inhalation. Her death is attributed to tear gas inhalation that happened during one of those demonstrations. So we encounter and have Palestinians who are engaged in nonviolent resistance, as Rachel was, internationals who are engaged in that, and also Israelis. The last time we were in Belain, I myself was overcome a bit with tear gas, and I was helped by one of the Jewish Israeli activists who I think regularly comes to Belain to join Palestinians in their protests, their weekly protests there. As far as, you know, what we continue to do at this point, our lives are very full. And thankfully, from my point of view, thankfully, they're not all consumed with legal aspects of things. We have the Rachel Corrie Foundation, which is located in downtown Olympia. And we have a lot of young people that we work with there who are students, interns from the college, the Evergreen State College particularly, but other colleges from in the U.S. and here locally. And we have a lot of different kinds of work that we're doing. As I said, Greg and I were at the play, My Name is Rachel Corrie, in Spokane last night, and we were invited to join the actress who performed the role and the director in a talk back with audiences. So we have a lot of opportunity to have conversations with people and to try to support education on this issue. We're very connected to people in Gaza, trying to build connections and maintain connections. That's the hardest part, but to maintain the connections with people there. So on a lot of levels, we're pretty busy.
Oh, that's awesome. There's a lot of people that are fighting in different struggles. I've got a question from an audience member, and he wants to know, have you heard of the 9/11 Truth Movement, and do you think that Rachel would have been a part of it, or was she a part of it that you might know of?
I have heard of that. I don't think that Rachel was particularly a part of that. I think that some of her activism, her curiosity about Gaza and Palestine started with 9/11 and not being particularly satisfied with President Bush's explanation that they hate us for our democracy. And, you know, she said she wanted to go to a part of the world and see what it was like to be on the other side of our foreign policy. And so I think it was tied that way, but she took a different step from it and just trying to look at what's going on overseas and what we're doing. Because ultimately, of course, I think she felt, and at least I feel, it's hard to speak for my daughter, particularly when she isn't around to argue with me like she did so often when she was alive. But I think we're responsible first for our own actions, and we're responsible for our own government's actions. And then we can look abroad and do that, you know, say what we want to do about that. So I doubt she would have been, but she would, you know, she died when she was almost 24. She would be 36 now, almost 36. So who knows? You know, that's hard for me to wrap my head around what she would be like in her 30s.
Right. Well, she was a very, very outstanding woman. And personally, me being a Palestinian from a Ramallah, my hats are off to her 1,000%. I wish that more people in the world were more alert to what was really going on. But unfortunately, the media, or should I say the Zionist media, here in the United States portrays Israel as the victim. It doesn't portray it as the victimizer or the occupier. It portrays it as a victim, as if these people that have no ancestral ties to the land all of a sudden do. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think I think we're all fortunate now. We're also kind of overwhelmed with the amount of choices we have in our media. And but what I find is, at least with our own story, even if the major media is not paying a lot of attention, that there are other avenues now for getting the word out, for talking with people. And I am heartened when we go to places. Last night was an example. Spokane is considered a much more, I think of it as being a more conservative part of our state. Eastern Washington and Western Washington are kind of characterized as having very different personalities and very different political views. And certainly elections that happen indicate that. They're more people that tend more to the right wing are elected in the eastern part of our state than here on the west side. But last night, that theater was packed with people who were supportive and, you know, some who had had a lot of knowledge and have had a lot of experience working on this issue, but others who had come because they were attracted, I think, by the idea of the theater and they knew something about Rachel's story, or who had been encouraged by others to come and were very, very receptive. And what Craig and I see as we travel around the country, sometimes in unexpected places, is that there seem to be a core of people, and it's growing in places, that are much more aware and questioning a lot more about what the U.S. role has been, what the Israeli role is, questioning that idea that Israel is the victim. I think many, many more people in this country are aware of the Palestinian situation than they were 12 years ago when we first became involved with this. And I think for Palestinians like you, it's just been too long and too dreadful. The losses have been, there are so many losses and of land and of lives over such a long period of time. But my sense is that the word is getting out and that we're seeing a change in. And I think part of it is reflected in the response to Netanyahu coming to the U.S. to give this speech at this time. I think there's a lot of criticism of that here in the U.S. And a lot of criticism actually in Israel, too. I have a friend who is an Israeli-Jewish friend who monitors the media there and was sending out reports today about some of the headlines. So I think while our media always needs to be monitored and challenged, and we know that it's been weak on this issue in a lot of places, we still do see those changes happening. And thank goodness we have sources, places where we can go for more complete information.
Weak is it's an understatement, more like crippled when it comes to the justice and the injustices that are done by Israel. But, you know, this goes hand in hand, I believe, with our Zionist Christians that are here in the United States that are also a part of this with their support for Israel. And I think that's a much bigger problem than the Jewish Zionists that are also, you know, heavily handed with what's going on there, and they're condoning the injustices.
I do think that that's another place where we're seeing some progress, at least. And I agree with you because it's the problem is multifaceted. We've got Christian Zionism, and and a large number of people, huge churches, where they're supporting what's happening to the Palestinians because they somehow feel that's going to fulfill their ideas, their beliefs, biblical prophecies, and at the expense of the Palestinians who live on this land. And it's very tragic. But we've also got the military-industrial complex in this country, big corporations, weapons manufacturers, and so forth, that are also benefiting from our foreign policy and by our reliance on these wars and conflicts for their business, and to support that kind of response in other places. So it's certainly multifaceted, but we work closely with people, with organizations like Friends of Sabeel, which really focuses on the churches. And we have seen, evangelicals who have come and talked about where they were some years ago and how they've been awakened. And there is definitely effort to, I think, challenge that point of view. And I hope we'll see more progress there.
Well, I'm sure you know as much well as I do that there are a lot that have some kind of common knowledge that'll wake up, but there are some that no matter what you tell them, or if you hit them over the head with a book of knowledge, and you still can't get them out of the deep mesmerized conditioning that they've been put into.
I don't think we have to worry about those people clear out on the end of the spectrum, though. I think that what we have to do is talk to people that are willing to think about it, or even if they won't think about it while you're in front of them, they'll go home and think about it. And one of the big sea changes, I think, has been in young Jewish people. So we work with Jewish Voice for Peace, for instance. Those people are really hard, activists on this issue. They speak out and with just incredible indignation about what Israel is doing, and take huge exception to Netanyahu speaking in their name. You know, they just say that is not true. And the Jewish young people in this country, I think under 30, 50% of them don't think we ought to be supporting Israel in this fashion. And I think that's a huge change, and I think it's promising. But of course, what's happening, in your neck of the woods, in Ramallah, where you're from and your family's still there, what's happening in the West Bank and catenizing all that is still going on. So we need to not just change the way some people are thinking about this issue in the United States. We need to change what the U.S. policy is, and then eventually and quickly change the facts on the ground as it applies to Palestinians.
Oh, absolutely. We're going to take a quick break real quick, and we'll be right back with our guests here on The People Speak. Mr. and Mrs. Corey will be joining us back in just a few more minutes. Time for a quick break.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive, but there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
This is Rock Cash, your host on The People Speak, coming to you live over the BBS Radio Network. Joining me are my guests, Craig and Cindy Corey, Rachel Corey's parents. Welcome back. On a break, we were discussing a little bit of me. Now let's discuss a little bit more of you and the foundation. How can our listeners help and assist?
Well, I think first, just look us up on the internet, so www.rachelcoreyfoundation.org, or if you get all that, just Google Rachel Corey, and you'll come up with a foundation up at the top. And you see some of the work that we've done. Of course, contributions are welcome, and they can actually, we're just trying to support one of the members of the family Cindy talked about near Ramallah, going to school at Brzeit. And so, you know, that's just one of the projects we're working on, is allowing a young woman to be the first in her immediate family to go to college. And that's really helpful. We also got a young man from Gaza who's going to college here in Olympia, Washington, and so Mohammed has got a scholarship. We also have another scholarship at the Evergreen State College for people basically from the United States that are going there and interested in Middle East and that sort of thing. So we've got that sort of thing going on, but also we do most of our work trying to make people in the United States aware of the situation in Israel-Palestine. Most of our work is around Israel-Palestine, although we've done a little bit, of supporting people who work in Sudan. It's a small foundation, and mostly it's grassroots. And more than money or whatever, getting involved personally. We've had summer interns coming from college from around the United States that have worked with us. We have local interns. And there are some places that actually send interns for a little bit longer, and volunteers that can work in any number of ways. And so we'd like to be supportive of what people want to do. It's a lot of grassroots, getting to know people in other parts of the country and maybe a little, or other parts of the world, and maybe a little bit different situation than your own. And it's wonderfully rewarding. So.
Craig and I are both full-time, I would say full-time or more than full-time volunteers for the foundation. But to keep an an effort, an organization like this going, we need to have a few paid people around. So we have a couple of young part-time employees that help us to keep things going. And that's really where we can use support. I sometimes think about like the advocacy that could be happening if we just had somebody who is regularly with us to pay attention to all of that. We just have more work to do than we can get done. We're really lucky to have the interns that Craig mentioned that come to us. But part of what we're doing, we just had a conference. We do a lot of education, so we host a lot of events. We had a conference that drew a couple hundred people to a wonderful talk at a full-day conference with Omar Barghouti, who's the founder of the BDS Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions effort to challenge the Israeli occupation. And Omar was in the Northwest, and so he spent a day in Olympia, which was great for us. And we brought activists from other movements. Jesse Hagopian, who teaches at Garfield High School in Seattle and is very active with Black Lives Matter. We brought a woman from British Columbia who is a First Nations person there, challenging some of the environmental degradation that's happening on her nation's land. And also a young man from Arizona who works both on the Palestinian issue and also on border issues there in along the Mexico border, and has been a humanitarian activist there for 6 years. But he's very aware of what's happening with our U.S.-Mexico border and about the role of Israeli companies, the Elbit system, and then others that he's learned are probably going to be moving into that area to engage in all of these security systems, because Israel has a lot of experience with security companies and so forth. So this was a really enlightening event for our community, but it's a piece of what the foundation tries to do. I'd say, too, Craig and I travel quite a bit and do, we don't go looking for it, but when people ask us to come and to their communities, if we can help to inform people about what's going on, we like to do that. We just spent about 5 days a few weeks ago in Ohio, and we were speaking in Toledo, in Cincinnati, and Columbus. We were guests of the Palestine Children's Relief Fund in two of those cities, and then with a local peace organization in Columbus, Ohio. We have a great time getting to know the people and to see the work that's being done in all these places, and we hope that we help to inspire people to keep working and give them some ideas about things that they can do.
I've got a ton of questions coming in to you guys. Reggie in Washington, your neck of the woods, he wants to know what your take is on the USS Liberty and the practice of false flag terrorism.
Of course, for those that don't know, the USS Liberty was a ship that was in the Eastern Mediterranean in 1967 during the war that Israel had with Egypt. Well, really most of its neighbors, and it was attacked by Israeli airplanes and not sunk, but I've forgotten the number of sailors that were killed, but quite a large number of them, and it's now common knowledge. And in fact, not only the sailors that were on it, but people intercepting radio transmissions back and forth at the time know that the Israelis positively identified that ship as American, but attacked it and tried to sink it anyway. I'm not quite sure why, but I think it's that they were listening to some of the radio traffic about the atrocities that were happening in that war. Maybe that they were about to turn around and attack the Golan Heights instead of continue on in the Sinai. So the upshot of all that is that the United States did not really ask for an investigation. They did not pursue that. They took the sort of apologies from the Israeli government, but I don't think there's ever been any reparations or anything like that associated with it. And I don't know why I knew about it when Rachel was killed, but I did. And I remember just the day after Rachel was killed saying, you know, if we will allow a warship to be attacked like that with no repercussions, it's going to be really difficult to get our government to do anything about, you know, one 23-year-old girl. And, yeah, I think, you know, that's just one part of the of sending, I think, really the wrong message to one of our closest military allies. To me, and I was in the military in Vietnam, you don't let yourself get jerked around like that. I'm not really proud, and I don't want to go down military logic because I don't really believe it, but that, to me, is really against military logic, and yet it happened.
Correct, but I think there was more of a picture. I think they were trying to entice a war between the two superpowers, but it failed. Elaine in Louisiana wants to know, did Corey know anything about Palestine, Israel before their daughter's death, or was it their daughter's death that got them involved to feel some sense of things happening for a reason, or to come with the terms of their daughter's death?
I think our family was a lot like a lot of American families. We didn't have a direct connection to the Middle East. We had heard about the Israeli-Palestinian situation, you know, all our lives. It was always there. It was always described as that problem that just would never find any solution. And, of course, I think more in the media at that time than now. Maybe it's just because I'm more tuned in, but my feeling is that at that time, it was pretty unheard of to hear any support for the Palestinian side of that in our media. And so it was the Jewish-Israeli narrative that our family connected to and identified with in some ways. And, you know, we shared stories. I read the story of Anne Frank, of Jews in the Holocaust, and of what happened to her and to my kids, you know. So that's what we were more familiar with. And I think we're, as I said, we're pretty typical of Americans at that time. We were pretty ignorant of the Palestinian part of the story. So it was Rachel who brought us to this, and she did that before she left to go to Palestine. She started educating me particularly because I had time to read more. She would point me to websites and ask me to take a look at things. Craig and I were living in North Carolina at the time. Craig had a job change, and even though Olympia has really always been our home during our adult lives, we were away during a several-year period there. And when I came to visit here, when I came home to Olympia, she would check out movies from the Evergreen State College Library about the occupation, and we'd watch them together, and she'd ask me what I thought about things that I saw. So she wanted very much for us to understand why she was going and what she was going to do and more about the situation. She didn't want us to be afraid, I know that, and I remember getting an email from her when she was trying to share more about the experience that she expected to have. She told me, you know, there were a couple websites I could look at, and then she told me another that might make me feel a little more nervous, but she pointed out that to that point, nobody in the International Solidarity Movement, the movement that she became a part of, had been killed. And there had been one or two injuries of people, but there hadn't been anybody who had been killed. And I think she very much didn't want us to be afraid for her. Rachel introduced us to this, thankfully, started our education before she went and before she was killed there. And then, of course, after that, we had the benefit of just being mentored by so many people who were much, much closer to the situation. And we've been welcomed in the Middle East by Palestinians and others, and, you know, have just had a very important training over the course of 12 years.
I think if your listeners sort of want to know what we were learning from Rachel, why she was alive, she was mostly writing emails to Cindy, and those have been published. You can go out to the Rachel Corrie Foundation website and see them. You can also go to look on The Guardian. The Guardian published them about 3 days after she was killed. So they did it in something they called Rachel's War, which I think is still out online. It'd be about March 18th or 19th of 2003. And also, more than just those emails, but she was a writer. Rachel was a writer all of her life. And that's been put together in a book published by Norton called Let Me Stand Alone. And, of course, Cindy and I just talked about seeing the play My Name is Rachel Corrie, which is it won 3 awards when it was originally brought out in London in 2005, I believe it was, when the play came out. It was it's edited from Rachel's writing, so the words in the play are Rachel's or emails from Cindy and me and somebody named a friend of hers named Todd. But it's edited by the British actor Alan Rickman and the British Guardian editor Catherine Viner. And that play has been really all around the world. I could probably count off maybe 20 countries and more than a dozen different languages it's been in. And I think Cindy and I have heard it in something like 6 different languages. So so her writing has gone a long ways, and it's compelling not just because of what she read and what she was seeing in Gaza, but from what she did before that. So when we read that writing, you know, we knew that what a great observer Rachel was, and we knew that what she said was true.
Well, one thing's for sure, Rachel lives on. She's never going to be forgotten. She's always going to be a part of the world, and of course she's always going to be a part of the Palestinian cause. With that being said, a friend of mine who is a Palestinian just asked me to ask you guys a question. But before that, he said, Rachel passed away, but for Palestinians and others, she did not die. Rachel will always be remembered as the brave, sweet girl who stood up for justice at the time when people didn't understand freedom stood for Palestine. It's very clear that justice for Rachel was not served. What is your opinion on or about the justice system in occupied Palestine?
About the justice system in occupied Palestine?
Yes.
That
would be Israel.
Yes, yes. It's been a very, you know, long, as I said, and drawn-out, frustrating process for us. We filed the lawsuit in 2005 at the point that statute of limitations would run out. We wouldn't have the ability to do anything legally if we didn't file at that time. Initially, one of the first things that happened is that the Knesset passed a law making it virtually impossible for anybody who was injured or killed in an area of hostilities for any legal action to be brought in those cases by Palestinians or internationals. And that was challenged by human rights organizations in Israel and from the West Bank. And eventually part of that was overturned. And then at that point, our case started to move forward again. But it was really halted for a couple of years while they were determining whether cases would go ahead in their courts. And then, of course, we had a very long lawsuit. We were naive in a sense. I think we thought we would go to Israel, and in a month or so, the case would all be argued and we would have a decision. Instead, it was before a single judge in the Haifa District Court. There are no juries in Israel, so the system is very different than ours here. And the judge had other cases, of course. So even though we were coming all the way from the U.S. and we wanted very much to be present for all the proceedings, that happened over the course of over a year in order to have 15 sessions. It was over a year that it took in order for those to take place. So it was very drawn out. And then it was more than a year before we had a verdict from the judge, and he found completely in favor of the Israeli military and said that Rachel was killed as an act of war. Our attorneys felt strongly, and we agreed with them that we needed to appeal that decision, in which the Israeli military was found to have no accountability at all, no responsibility. The only person blamed, actually, by the court for anything in the district court case was Rachel herself, basically for being there. And I'm always reminded when Craig was asked, I think at one point, about, you know, why was Rachel there, or should she have been there? And he said at one point, the question is, why aren't we all there, standing with the Palestinians, standing in this place where there is so much injustice? And but the judge in the case felt differently about it. We did appeal to the Supreme Court, and as you know, just recently, the Supreme Court stood with the district court decision and determined that the case should be dismissed, which is different than our system. If a case was dismissed in our system, that would happen very early. In the Israeli system, that's what they are doing at this point at the end of it. And again, the Supreme Court found that Rachel was killed as an act of war. They determined that the military determined that this was an area where there were hostilities towards Israeli soldiers. So even though on that day, soldiers testified in court that they didn't feel particular threat from the activists, the activists were something of a nuisance to them because they were standing between homes and structures where the bulldozers wanted to go and were trying to prevent them from demolishing homes that day as they had done so many other days. There were hundreds and eventually thousands of homes in Rafah where these activists were that were destroyed by these military bulldozers. The court found that even though Rachel was there with her orange vest and megaphones, and the activists would not have been out there if there was serious fighting going on between the military and resistance, Palestinian resistance. That was not happening at all that day. But the court found that still it was an area of hostilities, and therefore the military had no responsibility. So to answer your question, I think we're very disappointed in the outcome, and certainly disappointed in this system and how it continues, how through the courts they continue also to, as an institution, to support the oppression against the Palestinian people.
You know, if I can also chime in on that answer, because looking at it from a Palestinian point of view, you know, everything Cindy said was true, but that's coming from a very privileged family. I mean, it sounds awful, and it is awful, but we're the ones with privilege. We had the money to pay the court fees up front before you can even get to court. We could get in to the courts, whereas if you're from Gaza, you have absolutely no chance of getting into Israeli court, and you would have no idea where you might end up if you tried to go through, you know, to get clearance to go into Israel. And the West Bank, slightly better, but not really much more of a chance. So we at least had an ability to take it to courts. But there are very, for one thing, the West Bank and Gaza is under military rule. It's military law. It's a different set of laws than for Israelis. And Israelis are moving into the West Bank, Jewish Israelis. They are under not the military law, but they're under a separate law that applies inside Israel. And even, I know, you know, if you're from Ramallah, it might be hard to feel sorry for your brothers in Palestinians that live inside Israel, but 20% of the Israeli citizens are Palestinian, and yet they're differentiated on what they call nationality, which is, are you Palestinian or are you Jewish? And there are roughly 50 laws that distinguish on that. That's called apartheid under international law. Israel is an apartheid state, and I think the rest of the world needs to not only acknowledge that, but then start working against that, just like we did in South Africa. And I think that for those, like you said, your Jewish friends that have a hard time looking at this and feel sorry for Israel or think that Israel is being picked on, you know, I remember the same sort of thing being done by defenders of South Africa, and they felt like South Africa was under attack when people started trying to boycott South Africa. But in fact, that boycott was not an attack. It was a lifeline to South Africa. We can look at South Africa now and think of how much better it is because they ended the apartheid. They still got a lot of stuff to do, but we need to get at least to that same point with Israel. We need to join in the boycott and the divestment and the call for our government to sanction what's going on. And that's something we can do on a grassroots level and work with that to try to end the apartheid that's going on there.
I completely agree with you. One last thing before we go. I know that even in Israel, there is no justice for the Palestinians. Even if they take things to court against a Jewish member of Israel or an Israeli, they will never win the court case, no matter what. As represented in the movie The Lemon Tree, I don't know if any of you have ever seen that, but I suggest that you go out. You can get it on Netflix. The Lemon Tree pretty much explains how they stole land from a person that owned the farm. Anyways, I'm sorry, Craig and Cindy, but it is, unfortunately, we're coming to a close on the show. Hopefully, we'll have you back again another time. I would like to thank you very much from the deepest part of my heart. And I want you to know that Corey still lives in me. And
thank you so much.
She will always be there as a beacon of strength as we go on for this fight for justice for all of humanity, not just the Palestinians, but all of humanity that's unjustly being destroyed around the world. Thank you once again. Thank you very much for joining us. And we'll tune in next week to The People Speak. Our guest will be Amanda T., the Walking Dead fan whose petition garnered 70,000 signatures to bring back the character Beth. Okay, I know nothing about The Walking Dead, nor do I want to. But once again, thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Corey, and have a good evening and a good week. And this is Rock Cash signing out on The People Speak on the BBS Radio Network. Thank you, Don Newsom.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.